Isaiah 47.
These two chapters, 46 and 47, deal with Babylon and God's dealing with Babylon. Last time we saw the gods of Babylon were of course utterly incapable of dealing with the true God. And here we have the destruction of Babylon here in chapter 47. Now, let me mention this. Historic background, we've dealt with this a little bit. As far as Babylon is concerned, Babylon was taken by the Persians in 739 BC. But the Persians did not destroy the city. Now, Babylon at the time was at its peak as far as the size of the city, as far as construction and so on. But one of the things that they've had an issue with in lower Mesopotamia, where it's just pan flat, is you have, like you do in Egypt, but it's flatter. Everything is irrigation. You don't have rain a whole lot in southern Iraq. If you've seen pictures of the soldiers in the water-filled foxholes and that kind of thing, that's up toward the north. They get rain in northern Iraq. They can actually grow in the Assyrian areas. They could grow crops without irrigation. In the south, they're dependent on irrigation. Very, very dry down there and flat. And so if you have a my wife had this happen with a Christmas cactus. She'd had it for years. And you keep watering it in the little dish down below. You don't pour it in the top. You water it in the dish down below. And you keep doing that. You keep doing that with some plants. And then what happens? What do you notice over a period of time in the soil on top? You get a salty crust in there. Because you've got a little tiny bit of salt in the water. And over a period of time, as that water, you keep adding water and it evaporates up through, perks up through without having anything flush it out. You have an increase in salts. And they have the same problem in lower Mesopotamia. This has actually been the ruin of a number of different civilizations, where such as Texas, for example, where you keep irrigating, but you don't have enough rainfall to flush out the salts, and so pretty soon the salt content in your soil keeps you from being able to grow crops. In Texas, yes. Fix the problem in Texas. But anyway, so they were already having some issues. And then also when you have an area where it's very, very flat and you've got a river running through it, and your elevation is, you're only dropping, maybe a foot every 30 miles or something like that, your river moves very, 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 very slowly. And when you have a river situation like that, the rivers have a tendency to do this. They wind and meander around, and this is where you get oxbow lakes. Eventually, they'll wind enough, and it cuts off, and then you're left with a shallow lake over here, and the river takes a more direct route. But what happens also is cities that are built in these places have a tendency to the river leaves them, and so you got a town over here, and that was built originally on the river, but the river is now 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 12 miles away. Because the river changed course. All right. During the time of Nebuchadnezzar, during the time that Isaiah was writing this, the Euphrates ran right through the city of Babylon. Babylon straddled the river. Part of Cyrus's conquest of Babylon was the rerouting of the river. And so even though you had this, you had irrigation canals that could bring water there, the river was now several miles away. And over a period of time, without that river there, which was not only a source of water for irrigation and so forth, but was also transport. All right? So Babylon, great big huge city, no longer has the Euphrates there to feed it as far as water is concerned, no longer has the Euphrates there as far as transport is concerned. They can't run the barges up and down through the city because the river isn't there anymore. And so over a period of, it actually took centuries, Babylon fell into decay, and it wasn't until about 1,400 years ago that Babylon was finally just abandoned. So Babylon did not go through a situation like Nineveh did, where Nineveh was conquered and destroyed and wiped from the map and gone. And you've had a number of cities like that throughout history. Some of them sizable. Babylon wasn't one of those. Babylon had this change, basically a change in administration, but that one thing, the changing of the route of the river, changed everything long term. But one of the things that you have when you have a change in administration is there are there's always collateral damage. Now, when you see in the Bible, Old Testament prophecies regarding the destruction of Babylon, some of them are talking about just some serious obliteration of the city. That's not historical. So, here's the question. Are we dealing with an error in Scripture? Of course not. What does that mean? If we're dealing with the obliteration of Babylon, and looking back at history, that didn't happen to Babylon, what is required? What's that? It's still to happen. Which means, by the way, have they rebuilt Babylon? No, they haven't. Saddam Hussein wanted to, but he didn't get to it. Babylon will be rebuilt. Revelation 18 deals with Babylon. Now, are we dealing with a physical Babylon? It's kind of interesting. You read the different commentators and stuff written over a period of time, and the guys that used to write, 500 years ago, 400 years ago, 300 years ago, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, 60, 70, 80 years ago, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, they always assumed that Babylon was Rome. A lot of the early church writers, 2nd, 3rd century after the time of the apostles, they thought it was Rome. And with the change in the political situation that we have seen in the last couple of decades, the newer commentators are saying, we might be actually talking about Babylon. And so the rebuilding of a city, because you got to think about this, it's got a great location. These days you're not dependent on water for transport. You can have trains, you can have tractor trailers, you can have planes flying in there, and also with modern excavating equipment, stuff like that, you can create your own inland seaport. You can reroute the river without a whole lot of trouble. And Babylon is in the middle of the world as far as the crossroads between Europe, Asia, and Africa. You've got an abundance of oil nearby. You've got all the things that are necessary except for a really nice climate. But apart from that, you've got a great setting as far as location and reasonable access to raw materials. It's at the crossroads. And I think that somewhere down the road, there's going to be a new Babylon, and it's going to be a commercial enterprise, because that is what we're looking at as far as Revelation 18 is concerned. So when you read the Scripture and you're talking and it sees the destruction of Babylon, take in consideration that we may be dealing with something future instead of something past. What we have here is probably the past in Revelation, Isaiah 47. So he starts out with, "Come now and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon, sit in the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate." Several times this idea of a virgin daughter applied to a city or a nation is used in Isaiah. It's used outside of Isaiah as well, but in Isaiah in particular, it's used of a city that's never been conquered or a nation that's never been conquered. And Babylon, once it gained its independence of Assyria, had not been conquered. It had been an independent entity. It was thought to be unassailable. You could not conquer this huge city with the walls just indescribably huge. 150 feet tall, approximately 70 feet thick. How in the world are you going to breach walls like that? And of course, we know because the river ran under the walls, we find out that the Persians rerouted the river and marched under the walls instead of having to go through them. But we have sit down in the dust, O virgin daughter. There is no throne. They used to be in an exalted position. They used to be honored, this idea of royalty. And now they're sitting on the ground. They're sitting in the dust. And when you say the idea of dust, you're dealing with mourning. There's, of course, no longer a throne to sit on. And no more be called tender and delicate. And so you have these people that used to have everything done for them, because they had enslaved all these other peoples, and they did all their grunt work. We see this often in cultures that have conquered everybody else, and so they live high and mighty, and all the people they have conquered do all the hard work. They're the ones that have to do, the tilling of the field and the harvesting of the crops, and they make all the stuff. And one of the problems, by the way, with that is if you have that kind of thing going on for several generations, the country who did the conquering, we see this in Rome, forgets how to conquer, actually becomes dependent on their slaves, and the only skilled labor you have are slaves. This happened in the American South, for example. After the Civil War, there was no skilled labor in the South other than former slaves, because, that's not white man's work. And so the white man did without, because he couldn't do it or wouldn't do it after the war. So here's what becomes of the Chaldeans after the fall of Babylon, verse 2. Take the millstone and grind meal. Uncover thy locks, make bare the leg, uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers. The millstone, my wife and I usually go to Costco on Mondays. We're not going to do this tomorrow, but normally we go to Costco on Monday. And especially if my wife has some cake baking to do, she gets somebody that wants a wedding cake or a birthday cake or something. Okay, go to Costco and we get the 20 pound or 25, what is it, the big pound of bag of flour. 20? All right. And we keep it in a 5-gallon pail and all, you get a lot of flour. All right. If we need flour, we go to the store, we buy flour. All right. In the ancient world, for the most part, what did you do? You bought wheat or barley and you made your own flour. By the way, if you've ever had fresh ground flour bread, that's really good stuff. We're missing out on this. But what was their mechanism? You had a convex stone, all right, with a hole in the middle of it. You had a concave stone over the top, umbrella shaped, over the top of it, again with a hole in it. You would have a wooden peg in there, so that's your axle. Drive it through there so the stones are sitting on top of each other. And then on the top stone, you had another hole off to the side, and that's where you stuck your handle. And we're talking about something that's maybe 18 inches to 2 feet across. So this is heavy. And one of the jobs that women would have is they'd put the peg in the outside hole, and they'd have to spin this thing around. And they had a hole in the middle also where they'd pour the grain in. And then you had a cloth or something around the outside as this stuff gets ground and drops down so you get your flour. And cranking this thing around, there's no bearings. All right, you're just cranking this thing around by hand. That's hard work. You're moving this stone that probably weighs like 40 or 50 pounds. And what they used to have the slaves do there in verse 2, they themselves are doing. There is now a shortage of clothing. There is now a shortage of all things that they used to take for granted. And then it says, pass over the rivers. Thy nakedness shall be uncovered, yea, thy shame shall be seen. Rivers, we have a word for everything. In most languages, a word has a broader meaning. And this is true in a lot of the old Semitic languages, that when we talk about a river, does somebody have a different translation on this for the word river there in verse, at the end of verse 2? Let me see, is it right? End of verse 2? Okay, end of verse 2. Instead of river, what's it got? You pass over the rivers. What's that? Streams, okay. What you've got there probably is canals. Canals. You see this in satellite pictures of some places around the world today, where you've got a river, and then you've got this network, this grid of canals going out from there. And that's to increase the area, as far as agriculture is concerned. And they would bring it out 6-7 miles away that far, all done by hand with shovels and stuff. And so, if you're crossing over, that means that you've left the territory. You are moving out of the area. You are being carried away captive. And so we're dealing with enslavement here. And then it also says there in verse 3, that nakedness shall be uncovered very often for the humiliation of the captives. They would often be buck naked, chained to each other, carried off into captivity. And I will take vengeance, and I will not meet thee as a man. So we're looking at nakedness. There's an intimation in verse 3 of violation, perhaps rape, and enslavement. And so this is the status of what was formerly the great conquering nation of Babylon. Now, we have a slight digression here, a little parenthetical there in verse 4. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. And then all of a sudden we go back to Babylon. Just that one little thing there in verse 4. And it's a possessive. He's our Redeemer. So it is just this flashback letting the Israelites know that God is doing this, and at the same time God is redeeming them, because what is happening to Babylon is going to be, as we saw last time, the enablement for Israel to go back, to the Jews to go back to Judea, to rebuild Jerusalem, to rebuild their temple. So what is happening to Babylon is God's means of getting them back. So as for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Babylon's failure to learn from history. The next several verses here, the next three verses. People will learn from their own experience. This is the school of hard knocks. If you have gone through a trial and error and you learn, man, I don't want to do that again, and so you learn not to do that, or, man, I've never done this before, and so you do some study or you talk to somebody who has the experience, and you figure out how to do it, and the next time you do it, it's a lot easier because you know how to do that. And sometimes we can learn things from history, that there are certain patterns of how things work, whether you're talking about economies or how empires work or all these things. History repeats itself because the patterns lend themselves to certain things. If this happens, then this happens, and then this happens. And if this happens, then we start the whole process over again. It just rolls in a cycle like that. Technology may accelerate this, but the patterns repeat themselves over and over again. Now, Babylon should have learned some things. They saw this with Assyria, with the fall of Assyria. And so in verse 5 it says, "Sit thou silent, and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans. For thou shalt no more be called the lady or queen of kingdoms." All right, so here's an announcement that your doom is coming. Verse 6, "I was wroth," God says, "with my people," with Judea, with the Jews. "And I have polluted mine inheritance. I allowed the foreigners, the Gentiles, to come in, conquer them, to desecrate the temple. And I have given them into thine hand." He's talking about the Jews, but he's addressing Babylon. All right, so he's talking about the Jews, but he's addressing Babylon. So God was angry with the Jews because of their idolatry and so forth, and he used the Babylonians to punish, to judge Judah. And I've given them into thine hand, and thou that show them, there at the end of verse 6, no mercy. Upon the ancient thou wast very, that hast thou very heavily laid thy yoke. Now, we saw this with Assyria as well, that, how did I put it here? Babylon's abuse of Israel. When God uses Babylon, when God uses Assyria, when God uses even Egypt as a tool of judgment to correct Israel, because remember, Israel has to be preserved, to correct Israel, to chastise Israel, to be God's tool of judgment on Israel. The nations that God uses always go overboard. You know, it's like the parent who, come here, you lied, and we're going to give you a SWAT. And instead, the parent beats the child black and blue. All right? Instead of correction, it is abuse. And Babylon and Assyria, in this case Babylon, did that with Israel. They were supposed to be God's tool for correction in dealing with Israel, but instead, they abused their role and would not allow them to go back. They turned them into slaves and so forth. And therefore, because that they did that, they themselves will be judged. This is what happened to Assyria. This is what's going to happen to Babylon. Thou hast said, going back to the idea of the lady or the queen, thou hast said, I shall be a lady or a queen forever. My status is amazing. We are powerful. We are rich. We have a glorious city. It is immovable. It is permanent. I shall be this way forever. That's the mindset. That's the mindset. So that thou didst not lay these things to heart. What things? What happened to Judah? The Jews that are in your midst, why are they there? Because they thought the same thing. You go back and read Jeremiah, what was going on just prior to the deportation, just prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. And what was the mindset? Oh, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these. We will never be taken because we're God's people and His temple's here. And we live wickedly and we worship other gods, but we're going to pay lip service to God and God's going to deliver us because after all, He can't give up this temple and we're a permanent fixture and nothing's going to happen. And yet it did. And Babylon is exhibiting that same mindset, that they are permanent, they will never be vanquished, they are powerful, they are rich, it's never going to change. And they didn't learn the lesson from Assyria, and they didn't learn the lesson from Judah. So thou didst not lay these things to thine heart, neither didst thou remember the latter end of it. What is their confidence in? Well, in our own nation, in the U.S., Our confidence is in our military. Our confidence is in, to some extent, our isolation, that we have oceans on two sides of us, and that we have never been invaded by a foreign entity, and that we're rich and we have all this influence, and we have that I think a lot of that same mindset. We're invincible. And what is our confidence in? Our might, our technology, and our riches. What was Babylon's confidence in? Verse 8. They have delusions. There's several things here that are mentioned. Number one, verse 8 there. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasures. So they live sensuously because they can. It's kind of like your Hollywood elite and a lot of these other folks, some of the reason that they get behind all these radical liberal causes is because that's what they're doing. They want to be able to indulge in all the fleshly gratification and do it with impunity. You're given to pleasures that dwellest carelessly, without regard, that sayest in thine heart, I am and none beside me. All right, I'm invincible. I am God, if you will. What's going to happen? And she also says, I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. We're invincible. No one would attack us. We are secure. And then it says in verse 9, but these two things shall come upon thee in a moment, in one day. Boom. The loss of children and widowhood in one day. Now, this is not necessarily referring to the individual women of Babylon, but dealing with their status as a nation. And they shall come upon thee in their perfection for the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great multitude of thine enchantments. They're going to be judged because of that. It's kind of interesting. If you study, where did pagan religion come from? Where did all these sorceries and all the things that, where did witchcraft, and because this is all stuff that's very, very old. And it's all rooted in Babylon. This goes back a long, long, long way. This stuff that was going on, when you read the genealogies there in Genesis 11 and so on, that's where it started. It started even before the fall of Babel, and they took those ideas with them all around the world. So Babylon will be judged for this, because this is their confidence as well. This is their confidence. They are secure in their witchcraft. Verse 9, the bottom of verse 9 there, the second half. For the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thy enchantments, for thou hast trusted, verse 10, for thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. That's an odd thing to trust in. Thou hast said, none seeth me. There is no God in heaven that's going to see me, or God can't see me. I'm using my enchantments so that God can't see me. And I will never suffer the consequences of my sin because I have spells and enchantments that protect me. None seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge. And we're not talking about hard and fast, like, you know, one oxygen and two hydrogen to make water and that kind of thing. We're talking about the idea of enchantments and all these other things. It's kind of interesting. You go through the Old Testament, you'll find some oddball things. When you're reading through Jeremiah, and he talks about the king of Babylon was at the crossroads, and he looked at the arrows, and he looked in the liver. What's he doing? He's using enchantments. They would take a hand. You ever play pick up sticks? When you're, a few of you, okay. Okay, they would take a handful of arrows and throw them on the ground, and it would like reading tea leaves kind of thing. They would see how they arranged themselves on the ground, and they would make predictions based on that. Or they've actually found models of this where they would slaughter an animal and remove its liver and see how the lobes were arranged and everything else, and they would make determinations regarding the future and that kind of thing based on the liver of an animal. Now we laugh and mock, and yet how many people in America read their horoscopes every day because they did that too. They did that too. Is there any difference? I'm looking at the arrows. I'm looking at the sky. I'm looking at the liver. I'm looking at the sky. I'm still using inanimate objects to determine my future. And so they did all these things. Thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. And it says, it hath perverted thee, there in verse 10. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am, and there is none else beside me. It hath perverted thee. If you pursue a course of wickedness over a long period of time, and in this case you're talking thousands of years, but if you pursue a course of wickedness, wickedness becomes normative. There are all kinds of things around us that don't bother us anymore because we see them so often. Stuff that was, how people dressed when I was a little kid is different than it is now. And that wasn't that didn't seem like it was that long ago. And we're not talking about just style, but we're talking about how much of your flesh is covered up. Things that people did. What was considered moral in a culture? It's kind of interesting that your Hollywood crowd, by the way, has been immoral from the get-go. You go back and you find out that so-and-so was actually shacked up with so-and-so, but nobody talked about it. Now, everybody talks about it. Because nobody gets married anymore. The normative thing now is two people get shacked up or, and then that one doesn't work. We'll try this one. And people go through 3, 4, 5, 6 relationships in a 10 or 12 or 15 year period of time. They just keep shuffling around because that becomes normative. And so the perversion, becomes the normal thing. It hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thy heart that I am, and there is none else beside me. It's kind of interesting. Every society, every great society in history has gotten to that point. And then they collapse under the burden of their own indulgence and their own wickedness, their own affluence. Because they won't do what is necessary to sustain their power because it's too much hard work. And also the wickedness. Do you know that the Western cultures, almost all of them, if it wasn't for immigration from second and third rate nations, their populations would be nosediving. The United States, believe it or not, is dependent on immigration to maintain our population. We don't produce enough children in our nation because people don't too much trouble to have kids. There's too much of a commitment. What's that? That too. But again, why are we aborting them? It's inconvenient. It's too much trouble to have a child. It's inconvenient, so I'm not going to have the child. I want to indulge myself in being able to produce the child, but I don't want the child. And so I keep throwing away the inconvenient thing, even if it's a human life. I keep throwing it away. And Western societies, lowest birth rate in the world is in Germany right now. And Russia's not too far behind, by the way. Very, very low birth rates in a lot of these, a lot of nations around the world. Verse 11, calamity is going to come. Therefore shall thine evil come upon thee. Thou shalt not know from whence it riseth, and mischief shall come upon thee, and thou shalt not be able to put it off, and desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. You're secure, you think everything's fine, and then boom, it's over. In Daniel chapter 4, is that right? 5, I'm sorry, Daniel 5, we have Belshazzar's feast. Now, what's going on while Belshazzar's having his feast and this big, huge party with all his wives and all his concubines, and they're toasting the various gods and so on? What's going on at Babylon? Yeah, the river is being rerouted. But they are inside toasting all their false gods, toasting their invincibility, because they think that, yeah, these guys will go away like everybody else has always gone away. It says, and that night, Belshazzar the king was slain. And it came very suddenly. We're having our big party. We're celebrating. We're mocking the Persians' ability to conquer us. And yet that was the night that it happened. The folly of their confidences, beginning verse 12. And it goes back and forth. Verse 12. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast labored from thy youth, from the beginning, if thou shalt be able to, so that thou shalt be able to profit, and so thou mayest prevail. So you go down to the witchcraft shop over here, and they have these things, and they have these things around. The first time I ever saw it was at Washington's Crossing, outside of Trenton, New Jersey. And seeing where, they had witchcraft shops. I went there when I was a little bit younger than my kids. I was blown away. All these touristy things, and then there's a couple of witchcraft shops, and they weren't just, you know, they were selling amulets, and you go in there and you can talk, and they said, well, you have to have this, and you know, the I am Newt and all this other stuff. But they do this thing. They're serious about some of this. And they had this kind of thing all over the place in Babylon. And so if you wanted to have, if you had a business competitor that you wanted to get the advantage over, instead of getting a better product or try a different marketing technique, you went and saw the local witch and got some enchantment that would curse your opponent. And so the idea was business oriented there in verse 12. Verse 13, thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators. I love that because you see that one or two other places. What's a monthly prognosticator? Right? Okay. Let's look at these. The astrologers are looking at the stars and the sun. Stargazers are obviously looking at the stars. Monthly prognosticators. What changes every month? The phases of the moon. So the monthly prognosticators. So you got these three different types of sky gazers that are making determinations by what they see in the sky. By the way, this is one of the reasons why in ancient times, especially an eclipse or a comet or something, which was out of the ordinary and was not normally, with the technologies and stuff they had, real predictable. always upset things, and they thought it was a horrible thing and created all kinds of difficulties for them, at least in their minds. And so you have all these people that are reading the stars. And what they're doing then is says, stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. We're going to, before we were dealing with people who concoct potions and curses and so on, and amulets and this kind of thing. But you heard about the guy that had a St. Christopher's medal on the dashboard of his car, and he got in a head-on accident, and it went up and it went right through his head and killed him. That's happened more than once. And so dealing with the sorceries for profit and victory. They're going to be dealing with astrology for predictions and deliverance. Because if I read the stars, this is going to tell me what route the enemy is going to take. This is going to tell me how I can deal with the enemy by looking at the sky. And they've been trusting in this for thousands of years. Now, again, we think it's silly, but people read their horoscopes in America. And they have it here. Is it Meeker Mansion? They do this every year. The fortune telling thing there at Meeker Mansion. Remember we used to joke and say fortune tellers or something like that. They have a thing and they says, well, why should I bother letting them know I'm coming? Because they should already know. Hosting these things, but we've got this people around here. You go across the Bible Belt in the South, and you will see all the time billboards with a hand on them. Palm readers all over the place in the South. All over the place. And again, nothing new. And so they're looking at the astrology for predictions so they can gain a military victory over the Persians. Again, relying on what they had always relied upon. But what's going to be the outcome? Verse 14. Behold, they shall be as stubble. We talked about stubble this morning in the morning service. What's stubble?
Trash, garbage.
Yeah, it's what's left after you're done harvesting your grain. It's the straw that's still attached to the ground. And what they would do, they used to do this in the Willamette Valley. I don't think they do it anymore. They still burn the fields in the Willamette Valley. After the harvest, they would go through there and they would torch the fields. And so when you burn grass, well, let's read the passage. It says, behold, they shall be a stubble, fire shall burn them, and they shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There shall not be a coal to warm at, nor fire to sit before it. All right? So yesterday we had the big to-do at our house, and I don't know why they wanted to do this. It was 80-something degrees, but after the crowd thinned out a little bit, the kids wanted the fire pit lit. Sasha's sitting there going, no, it wasn't me. But I know why they wanted it, because they got out the marshmallows. That's what they did. Okay. All right. Now, when we do that, we use the fire pit in our backyard. David cleaned it on, yesterday morning. And what we did is we kind of run our fingers through it or something like that, and we pull out all the big black chunks and then have the ashes in the middle and scoop out the ashes and we kind of roll the coals back in. Because that's going to burn. That's going to catch real easy once we get the thing going again. When you burn grass, do you have coals? No, you just have ash when you're done. There's nothing left. If you're going to burn wood or something like that, at least you're probably going to have some coals to be able to use for later on. But here you've got nothing. He says it's like the burning of stubble. There's nothing left. There's going to be nothing worthwhile when you're all done. There's not even coals to warm fire of coals to warm your hands with, nor fire to sit before it. And then in verse 15, thus shalt thou say, thus shall they be unto thee with whom thou hast labored, even thy merchants from thy youth. They shall wander everyone to his corner, and none shall save thee. All these merchants, these traveling potion sellers and so on that are going to have their amulets and so on to deliver you from the invader. What are they going to do? Oh, trouble's coming. So I have a business meeting in Tyre, and I'm going to be heading that way. Time to move on. And that's what's going to happen. There's going to be none left to deliver. There is no deliverance. Their lifelong confidences in their witchcraft and sorceries will be gone, and they will be abandoned to suffer their fate. All right, any questions or comments or other additional ideas here? All right. This is not so far removed from where we are as a nation. It really isn't. And again, this has come very quickly in America. It's been the last generation or two that we've seen a something. There's always been some, but as far as depth and permeating the culture, it's a fairly recent thing, where we have a culture that lives for pleasure and has totally set aside the things of God and embraced all these other things. Randy, you had. All right, let's close in prayer. Oh, yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, you were talking about Germany and Russia being slow at birth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Well, China's there, too. They only have one child.
No, they have a policy for only one child. It doesn't mean that's all they're actually having.
Oh, it's a policy?
Yes. If you have, a couple is only allowed to have one child. If you have more than that, you're supposed to abort. You're required to abort. There's some municipalities, some regions where they're a lot more permissible. There have been forced abortions where a woman didn't want it and they went and arrested her and sedated her and aborted her child.
I see.
Matter of fact, this is a huge problem in China and in India right now. Because with the advent of ultrasound, you can determine the sex of your child before it's born. And in those cultures, you want to have a boy. That is a very, 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 very important thing. And so if they're aborting the girls, and they have been doing this for 20 or 30, well, about 20 years now, and there's a shortage of women. There's some places where it's like a 60-40 ratio, and sometimes even more than that. There's not enough women to go around. There's places in China, because you have more girls living in the country than in the cities, because in the country they don't have the ultrasounds, they're kidnapping girls in rural China. But this is a big problem. But people didn't think of this in advance. And how do you fix it? You have to wait. You have to wait another generation in order to fix the problem. And so you have, again, some of these places, it's most dominant in cities because that's where the ultrasounds are, where you're getting a very, very skewed ratio as far as gender is concerned. So, and that will result eventually in wars as well, if it becomes pronounced enough. What's that? Is it worth saying?
It's all that testosterone, hasn't
it? All right, let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you that your word is true. And Father, as we read about these judgments, we read about the various things that are going to happen, we read about the catastrophes and calamities that are going to happen and have happened throughout history. And Father, they are part of your program in judgment of sin. And Father, this makes us even more long for the coming kingdom. And Father, I think that we ought to pray as you instructed us regarding the coming kingdom. Father, may it indeed come. May it come quickly. And Father, we look forward to that time when sin will be banished and all these causes for judgment will all be taken care of and it'll all be over and done with. And we will live in a world as it ought to be with the real king on the throne. Father, thank you for that. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.